Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms. It's Sunday, October 26, 2014, and welcome to episode 86 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. In other words, it's a bunch of straight white males furthering the gender normative paradigm of computing. So let's get to it. I'm joined today by a very diverse group, starting with Earl Evans. Hello, Earl. How are you?
I am very diverse. I'm a different person every day.
Excellent. You cycle over yourselves. We're also joined by Paul Hagstrom, who I believe is on the Earth almost directly south of me. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing good. How are you?
How are things down south?
Oh, balmy.
Are they balmy way down south there? Okay. And if you go even wayer down south, you end up
on the top of the world.
Exactly. You scroll over, it's the top of the world. It is Michael Mulhern. Hello, Michael. How you doing?
Good morning, everybody. No, I'm doing great. If you can put apart the fact that we had another 36 spring day. So 100 and a bit in the Fahrenheit, I think that is.
Those are made up nonsense degrees.
Okay, 27 refrigerators.
Okay, excellent. Well, we are, as I said, it is episode 86, and that means we are continuing in our quick look at the beginning of each show of the milestones of the equivalent year back in the 1980s, and that brings us, of course, to the milestones of 1986, a fairly big year, less an explosion of new computers, new technology, and new hardware, as were, say, in the first half of the 80s. But we start to get a lot of movement and excitement in software and that sort of thing, and still new and exciting computers. I'm going to kick us off with one of them, which was one of the latest, one of the last, in my favorite series, the Apple II series. It was the Apple II GS. I never really became a huge fan. I had one at the time. I still was into the Apple II series. I had sort of merged over to the Mac, picked up an Apple II GS, but I never really embraced it and loved it the way I did and still do the 8-bit computers. So what about you guys? Any Apple II GS fans here at the table?
No.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of in the same boat. I started too early, and so the 2GS still has this like newfangled feel to me. So it sits there and it's blue, and you know I
totally know what you're saying.
Yeah,
yes.
I use it as if it were just, you know, kind of like a fast Apple IIe with an ADB port.
I don't like that blue surrounding on the, like, that's, I just change it.
Yeah.
I don't like that. It feels too much like sort of a low-end Mac to me, so it's a less exciting Mac, even though it's for the time it's exciting, because it's a color version of kind of a Mac that's Apple II. It was just too much a foot in each camp for me. I wanted a full-on Macintosh or a full-on 8-bit Apple II, and just it didn't quite do it for me. I never found the joy there.
Despite being a Commodore fan, I cut my teeth on an Apple II and stayed somewhat knowledgeable about the line, but when the Apple II GS came out, I have to admit, I didn't even know it came out. I knew about the Macintosh, we had them at work, but the Apple II GS was a complete mystery to me until I actually got into retro computing and found out that, oh, there was another Apple II model?
Yeah, the only thing I ever really did of any significance on an Apple II is I ran a BBS on an Apple II. I had a card that went in it that gave me either three or four additional serial ports. And so I ran modems on those as well. So I had a big multi-line BBS on it. And so that was fun.
This is the GS, you mean?
Yeah, the 2GS. Mm-hmm. So, but end up being expensive because you got to have, you know, all those phone lines in your house and things as well. So I don't really know why I was doing that, but I did. That's basically that and playing Task Times at Tonetown. That's basically that's the Apple 2GS for me. So what other big exciting hardware came out around 86, guys? What do you got?
Well, Compaq beat IBM to the market with the 386 desktop computer. I thought that was pretty good. Now, IBM did. Always coming second, poor old IBM.
Poor old Big Blue. So basically, so far, we're just down on everything to do with Blue and computers. what else? Earl, do you have anything else you could suggest that came out hardware-wise?
I think that the Mac Plus was probably where the Macintosh really turned the corner into an amazingly useful machine. I mean, not to say that the original Mac and 512 didn't have their charms, but I think the Mac Plus is where it really hit its stride. And we had one of those at work as well and immediately turned to using that for doing our newsletters or anything that needed any kind of professional-ish sort of publication value. It's just a beautiful with the, what was it, the 10 or the 20? I think it was a 10 megabyte drive that sat underneath it and docked to it. And that's just, I really think that's the beginning of useful Macs.
Yeah, I think I agree. I hate to admit it, but I didn't really like the, you know, the 128K Mac very much when it came out. It just seemed slow and like a toy.
It was very under capable for what it needed to be. It wasn't until the 512, I think, that the Mac became actually useful. And the Mac Plus made a big difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, Paul, what else do you got that came out maybe in other things, software, devices, events? Throw something out that's exciting about 1986, the year that was.
Well, fortunately, I have a bullet point list in front of me. And one of them is IMAP. Which is sort of interesting. IMAP developed by Mark Chrisman at Stanford University. I didn't really realize it was that old. And it is true that there are people are still supporting POP, but that had a big impact, and that was longer ago than I would have imagined. Anyone want to complain about POP?
Well, apart from the fact that one of our largest ISPs. For quite a while, up till recently, was still pushing POP over IMAP, and that was a real pain.
I mean, I guess one of the things I think that IMAP has really done there is a centralized server model. You know so now that it's possible to connect to the same sort of central mail server from several different places, you want to be able to keep track of it in some way that doesn't involve downloading, you know, several copies of the messages everywhere. And so, you know, that's a pretty early for at least the like microcomputer use early centralized server.
Yeah, I know that most people are more using IMAP now with their mobile devices and everything, but I was even finding POP3 to be quite painful in the early 2000s. It's even then I was using a Sony Clio and viewing my emails on that, as well as using the computer at work and computer at home. So, you know, mobile computing, yeah.
The Clio is like a tall palm, right?
Yeah. It's a Sony Clio. It uses the Palm OS, has a flip top screen and a separate keyboard. Quite a nice device. But, that was, I suppose, more than 10 years ago that POP was starting to really annoy me. But as you said, you don't want to be downloading your email on multiple devices. And if you've got it as download and delete from server, you can only get it to that one device. But IMAP's definitely was when I found an ISP that supported IMAP, I was over so fast.
What I think is kind of interesting about that, you know, to keep talking about email, but email actually wasn't that big of a thing in 1986. I mean, you know, it's taken over our lives now, but it's interesting. The volume was much smaller.
I'm actually fascinated to find out that the IMAP protocol goes back so far. Mm. We were in the 90s, we were really trying to switch over to it from pop. And I got the impression then it was kind of the new kid on the block. So, yeah, and one of the things I noticed, it wasn't so much how good the protocol was, because IMAP was great. It's more the implementations in some cases that held you back. Like, we tried to light up IMAP using the Netscape email software. I can't remember what the name of their server software was, but on POP, it ran beautifully. And on IMAP, it just leaked memory like a sieve. And we had to reboot the server practically every day when we were trying to run that. It was terrible. So, you know, it's, man, it takes so long for these technologies to get properly implemented. Come on, programmers.
Come on.
Okay, back to 1986.
For me in 86, software-wise, on our bullet points here, we've got Adobe Illustrator, which was, you know, not my preferred drawing program, but has subsequently basically taken over my life. So I've spent so many days, years, months, however much cumulative using that. But I think more fun, I would say, would be the various games. Because by 86, like, there were a lot of home console games, but there were still some great home computer games. Top of my head, Hollywood Hijinks, I think, came out in 86. So that's an Infocom game, and one of my favorite Infocom games, as were things like Alter Ego and Amnesia. So still a time where a lot of really great adventure games were coming out. So to me, this is still riding a high crest of adventure gaming. So when I think back to 86, I think back to adventure gaming in text and in graphics. So big time for me there. So what about in events, guys? What happened? We've got some bullet points, but I don't even know half of these things. But what went on in 86 that would be exciting to recall?
I think we should immediately talk about the December 86 issue of Compute Magazine, because it when it describes the market share of home computers, Commodore is, of course, 31%, which is as much as Apple and Atari combined. So I think we ought to talk about that for the rest of the show.
So, but what happened then?
Leading Edge is leading the lower edge there too. At
1%. It was leading that edge.
Interesting.
It just picked the wrong edge.
Is the 12% by IBM? We're pretty sure that wasn't the PC Junior, right? Because that flopped in the marketplace, like we talked about before. So were those actual PCs and PC XTs that were making it into the home? Interesting.
I guess so. And then would be taking off from there. It'd be really interesting to pair this against the next year then, because these numbers would change dramatically, I think.
Yeah.
Leading Edge just basically took over.
That must be an alternate reality I'm not familiar with.
Yeah. So looking at the list here, just for our listeners, we've got going in order from top to bottom. Here are the top computer manufacturers. Like, here's basically where the home computer market stood near the end of 1986. We got Commodore at 31%, Apple, woohoo, bringing up number two at 16%, Atari at 14 and a bit, 14.7%, then IBM at 12%, and the bottom of the barrel, the bottom two, were Tandy, still in there at 9.5%, and, like we said, Leading Edge with 1% of the market. And they should have enjoyed their 1% while they had it.
But that does actually make the lower three all PC compatibles, though, right? I mean, I assume that's what Tandy's 9.5% is.
Could have been the Tandy 1000 machines that wound up with some of the same technology, like I saw of the IBM PC Juniors, but were way more of a success.
And I wonder if this is, because not having the article in front of me, I wonder, is this sales in 1986, or is this like where we stand? Because there'd be a lot of legacy Tandy and TRS things out there, like the Coco would still be around. There'd be people still using a lot of older computers.
Oh, that's a good question. So what's in service versus what got sold?
Yeah, and I don't know which they mean. Probably this is sales. When they're talking market share, normally you mean sales, but I don't know. Interesting. So what else? Michael, what have you got for us for 1986? What happened?
Well, there was the Communist Manifesto. The Hacker Manifesto was published in the FRAC magazine back in January 86. So that was an interesting little essay.
We will link to it in the show notes so that we all get put on a list.
I could never tell with...
Probably already on that list.
It is a computer security guy. I've read that numerous times. I could never tell whether or not they were saying what we're doing is good or if they were saying what we're doing is bad, but it's okay, we're rationalizing. It's a fascinating document. I think anybody interested in the beginnings of the computer security realm and the hackers versus the white hats and stuff like that should read that early document, because a lot of the thought process, came derived from that going forward.
So let's see. Microsoft went public in 1986.
Oh, yes.
Stock's going to tank. Don't invest. Yep.
March 13, 1986, the company went public. The share price rose from $21 to $28 on the first day of trading, and in our bullet points, it indicates this makes Bill Gates one of the world's youngest billionaires.
$28, still a steal. I would have happily bought on day two.
And... my favorite, Vaporware is first used in print in a Time magazine article. I'm sure I was aware of the term Vaporware before then, but this is the earliest time that it's actually found in print. So
they were actually talking way back in 1986 about Half-Life 3? Cool.
Duke Nukem.
Yep. Duke Nukem actually eventually, the last one came out. Half-Life 3, on the other hand.
No, there was always lots of different things popping up that never eventuated or seemed to drag on to forever. But first time used, Philip Elmer DeWitt. Maybe he thought he was being clever, but I'm sure it was being used before 86.
And then I guess I'll round us off with a last one, which I find, which really tickles my fancy here, in the book Hard Drive by Wallace and Eckerson. According to that, Steve Ballmer, in this is the year he tries to convince Bill Gates to abandon Windows and like put everything behind Presentation Manager for OS 2. And foolishly, Bill Gates ignored that advice and thought Windows might go somewhere. Ugh, one of the biggest blunders ever. He must regret that so much. Can't believe he backed that horse. So 86, an exciting year. I remember it well. I think I was in high school. Girls had been invented by then, so it was good times, though it was mostly still just computers. Other people have been invented as well, and they occasionally listen, and when they listen, they occasionally write to us. And I think because of that, we have some listener feedback again. So Earl, why don't you tell us what the rustling in the wind has spoken to you?
Sure. We've got a number of emails that were sent to us, and so I'm going to cover some today and try and get to some of the other news items going forward. But Emil mentioned we had given not enough consideration to an important milestone of 1985, which was the introduction of the Amiga 1000. I had somehow completely just totally lost track of the fact that that was the first Amiga model, and so it's more of a big deal than I made it out to be when we had the show. It kicked off a line of computers that I think pretty much everybody agrees was ahead of its time. Had graphical, audio, and multitasking abilities that just jumped out to the head of the pack. And sadly, I mean, it's pretty widely known among the computer Illuminati that Commodore's marketing is what killed this. It wasn't the fact that the machine didn't have chops or, you know, couldn't get out there and on a feature versus price or whatever comparison, it could have done some really good things. But Commodore just danced around until the Amiga went to its grave. So that's sad, but it's cool that we have them today. They're collectible, they're neat, and so the Amiga 1000, there, we've given it its due.
Too bad we don't have any Commodore fans on the show. They would have known about it.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, yeah. Thanks,
Earl.
Thanks, Carrington. Yeah.
And on that, the Amiga OS is still available for today. So it does live on for more current machines, the Amiga OS. But yeah,
indeed. And there's even a clone of the Amiga OS that continues to this day as well. So the Amiga legacy definitely lives on. unfortunately, the company doesn't live on anymore. And like other things Commodore, some of the stuff for Amiga has been bounced around and kind of abused in history's recycle bin. But you're right, Michael, there's still a lot of Amiga that's still usable and out there today and supported. Also, Tony wrote in with a link to a really good YouTube video. I love watching stuff like this. This is a documentary. It was made in 1980. It was produced by a local TV station. I think it's on the East Coast somewhere. I can't remember where. But anyway, it's done really tongue-in-cheek. It's a neat time capsule. You see the haircuts. I love 1980 haircuts. It's just really something. Sideburns all the way, you know, down to your neck. And this is about 25 minutes, so it's not just one of those quick blurb sort of things. They actually cover a number of the different computers that were available at that time. And the computer even gets a little rascally word in or two. And I'll let you watch the video to catch how that happens. I had a lot of fun watching this, so we'll have a link in the show notes. And thanks, Tony, for shooting that to us.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and that's it.
Well, fantastic. I like that link a lot as well. I highly recommend people head over to the show notes. Show notes are, of course, at our rcrpodcast.com. You can check out that link and everything else we're going to talk about in the show and the gift guide and all the other goodies we have for you. So let's dive down now into our items of interest / news, as the way we title it in our show notes. Looks like I've got the first one, and it's a shorty, and I like it because it's Toronto-based. Oh, the city I live in and love. T-Pug, the Toronto Pet Users Group, they meet regularly, and I did not know this, but they meet regularly at a Starbucks, and they play games, and they lug their old Commodores there. So they gather around, they bring them, they bring plugs, and they invite other people to play, and there's a great video actually on the official Starbucks YouTube channel showing this meeting that they have. And so it's really, really cool. Two comments sort of jumped out at me that I want to bring up. The first is something I think I've mentioned on a previous show, and I'm not sure, so I thought I'd bring it up now, in that, well, I have historically been sort of, maybe, kind of an Apple guy, you could say. but I am aware of the Toronto Pet Users Group because it's been around forever. And I had a really good friend named Derek in high school whose dad had something to do with T-Pug. He was like one of the founders or one of the early members or what have you. And it was Derek who used to tell me about T-Pug back in the 80s. So it has been around that long, and it's the same users group still meeting. That's super cool. What I found interesting, though, is on the Starbucks site, if you look at the video, and you really should, it's a really fun little video of this gathering and seeing all the general public look at the big computers come in and get set up on desks and get invited to play, and it's really fun. But for the most part, the comments are all just saying it's a bunch of hipsters. And so my question to you, fellow retro computing roundtable panelists, are we hipsters? Is that what's going on? Because I don't feel like a hipster. Like, if I have glasses, I need them. They are not just empty frames. So I find that kind of funny that people would say, oh, like, it's like, you know, you got your fixie bike or you got this thing where you're just liking it ironically. And I think it's the exact opposite of that. This is a love for things as they are. It's not ironically pretending to like retro computers. It's actually enjoying them. But what do you guys think? Are we tinged with hipster? Should I be worried about that?
Yeah, I liked the SX64 way after it was popular.
Perfect answer. Yeah. Thank you so much. Okay. Well, then that settles that.
Well, my idea on this, retro is big right now, and we're happening to catch a wave that we're just getting swept up in, perhaps, that everything retro is big. Clothing styles,
I like retro before it was cool.
Yeah, exactly. It's like in the 70s when I was digging the Beatles, and then Beatlemania came out, and everybody was like, hey, the Beatles were so cool. I'm like, I know, been there, done that.
So we are hipsters.
We are, but only temporarily, because when the retro wave washes back offshore, then we will be the nerds that we've always been.
But if it's a shore thing, then it'll come back, and we can say we were hipsters before the hipsters.
We'll be dead.
You probably wouldn't have heard of them.
We'll be dead. We'll be dead by
then. So it turns out, shamefully, bunch of hipsters. Okay. So, Michael, you're going to bring us back to all the Apple guys are talking about other stuff this time. It's crazy topsy-turvy. But you know topsy-turvy. You live upside down.
No. You live upside down. South is up. South is the top of the world.
Excellent. Well, from here in the bottom, from the bottom, I stab at thee and I ask, what's with this Amiga Compendium Kickstarter campaign?
Okay, well, this is the link to the Kickstarter for the Visual Compendium for the Amiga. The same guy who bought us the Visual Compendium for the Commodore C64. Now, I promised the link to this one, but it wasn't available in time for our last show. But it is now, 16 days to go. They've got a £25,000 target, and they've only achieved 84 and a bit thousand so far. So I think this one's a goer. And if the Commodore compendium that Sam put out previously, which I was a backer, is an example of what the Amiga one's going to look like, it's going to be a great coffee table book, a good read, and very visual from the samples that I've seen of it. So if you're an Amiga fan, this is the one for you.
Interesting. Is the C64 one out already?
Oh, yes, yes. It's shipped. Everyone should have their copy by now. So, Earl, did you get the first Commodore compendium?
Sadly, I did not back that, although I've heard it's just a gorgeous – I've heard it's artwork, basically.
Oh, it is. It's very, very beautiful. That one is, I believe, actually now available to order outside of the Kickstarter. So I think it's a little bit more expensive than the Kickstarter price, but yeah, so this one looks like it's going to be another hit. Well, at least there's enough people who think that it is. So there's currently just under 2,000 backers for this, and as I said, just over £84,000 of the £25,000. So this one's definitely a goer.
I like it. Good link. Paul, now I expect on this next piece that you're going to be able to dive deep and give us tons of details.
Right.
I'll expect nothing else from you.
So
tell us about the Xerox Alto source code being released and the fact that I can no longer speak.
Yes. Well, so the Computer History Museum is continuing on its crusade to release all the kind of old system software and stuff from historical computers. The most recent achievement is that with the permission of the Palo Alto Research Center, Computer History Museum has made available for non-commercial use snapshots of the Xerox Alto source code, which is pretty amazing. So, and it's massive too. If they have it organized, there's a link to kind of like the announcement and kind of the background of the Xerox Alto, and sort of buried in there, you can find the links that go to the actual archive, and then they also have a tour of the archive. So, because the actual archive is really just kind of like a list of a couple of different file systems, you know, disks that they tapes and things that they got stuff off of, and you can sort of dig around, really just pretty much raw. But they do have a sort of like a walkthrough that tells you, you know, kind of where you can find stuff and what's there, and it's really it will take you a very long time to go through all this, but it's excellent that it's available. And so I did take a little bit of a look inside the archive at some of these files, and it seems like half of them are just lists of you know, bytes, and I don't know how I haven't got the first clue as to how to do anything with it, but I really like the fact that it is there, and someone who has a clue could do something with it.
I find something curious about it. Not a criticism of this by any means, because the work to do this digital archaeology is appreciated. It's a heck of a lot of work. And like you mentioned before we recorded, Paul, some folks have been at this for a long time, perhaps, you know, starting to measure into the decades. But interesting about the non-commercial provision in the release of this software. I noticed that with the CPM source code as well. Mm-hmm. And it got me wondering who would take this source code and attempt to parlay it into a commercial product in 2014. It just doesn't seem like somebody is sitting there chomping at the bit going, well, you know, I haven't made my millions so far, but now that the Alto source code is out there,
I'm ready to strike.
That's my ticket to you know, wealth and fame. And so what is the non-commercial aspect of this for, I wonder? I'll just throw that out.
Because the commercial aspect worked out so well for Xerox.
Exactly.
I think it's just one of those things where people are like, just they shut down and think, you can't make money off this. It's mine. Or what if it's worth a gold mine? Or I don't understand it. I really saw my own stuff, but in the public domain, I don't get to thinking. I just think that's just probably not that they were thinking there was some commercial use. It's just that by default, people say, if we're not going to make money off it, gosh darn it, nobody is.
I mean, I suppose one thing that they wouldn't want would be for someone to take the Computer History Museum's work and then sort of repackage it and sell it, you know, as a historical archive. Rather,
because it's a zero-sum game of knowledge in the world. Again, I don't see how that even would hurt them. And what kind of market would there be for that anyway?
Well, people who don't know about the Computer History Museum, I guess, but do know about the Alto. Yes, a very small set of people.
That's a Venn diagram with a tiny little, not a lot of non-overlapping on there, but okay.
Yeah, the people who'd be interested in it, I'd say, would be pretty up on finding it for themselves.
So anyway, the fact that it's released, though, the source code is very exciting. So I'll make sure that we link to like everything. Well, let's link to this announcement about it. We'll link to the actual source code archive. And like Paul said, there's that walkthrough. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to look at it and not just want to look at source code, it's sort of nicer to go through the walkthrough. So I make sure we'll link to the walkthrough over at computerhistory.org as well, because that's probably the best starting point for people who are interested in getting sort of just an overview of this that not only tells you about it, but also has lovely, pretty pictures of Star stuff and Xerox things, and there's some lovely photos in this. So definitely worth checking out. So looks like, Michael, we are throwing back to you at the top of the world for one last news item. Woz has a new job. How can that be?
Well, he's been kicking around unemployed for so long, so I suppose...
Poor Woz.
Yeah, I know. He invented that wonderful device, the Apple II, with the help of his mate Steve.
What has he done for us lately?
Oh yes, there's a good segue on that. But yes, he's taken a position as an adjunct professor to be a key part of the University of Technology of Sydney's Magic Lab, the university's Centre for Innovation and Enterprise Research. So. To me, at the moment, that's lots of words. Not quite sure what an adjunct professor does or is, but Paul, can you help me out on that?
Oh well, I mean, that's a label that's often used for people who just sort of are not in the regular kind of like tenure track stream that academics usually
have. Usually think of it as just fancy word for assistant professor.
Yeah,
it's like part-time professor.
But I think so basically he's going to pay him to turn up
and look pretty.
Yeah. Well, okay, turn up.
Turn up and dance. Dance for us, Woz. Dance.
See, the thing I think about this is I would hope that whatever subject matter that he's teaching on doesn't get obscured by the fact that it's Woz. And,
well, no, it's going to be a cooking class, I believe. So yeah. I don't think that's going to be an issue.
Perhaps dancing.
I'm pretty sure it's cooking, it's home ec, and maybe welding. But they're definitely going to keep him away from any other tech.
But he's such an exciting and excitable
awesome.
Character that learning just about any technical thing from him would be a joy if you could just, you know, dial down the hero worship just a little bit and engage in the classroom. He was a teacher, right? Wasn't he? Isn't that one of the things that he did after Apple was being a teacher for? Was it high school kids or middle school? Or come on, you Apple guys!
That sounds familiar. I know. Sure. I know that he's definitely been very, very sort of pro education. In fact,
he's one of those guys.
Yeah, I think if I'm not mistaken, I think he gave one of the first, you know, Apple Ones away. To Lisa Loop, I think, who had, you know, for the purpose of you know, teaching her students with it.
And he certainly has no problem talking in front of groups, in front of a classroom setting. We found that at Kansas Fest when he was there, it was super fun to meet him, and he's you know, gregarious and has no problem controlling a room and talking to them without being sort of overwhelming. Great personality for that sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd be very effective. And I think he's it seems like it's been known for a while that he's interested in moving to Australia. So perhaps this is just, you know, his excuse.
Ah, right, right.
Yeah.
Australia.
Was Australia.
The difficulty of managing a business today is that when you're up to your drawers in day-to-day problems, you can lose sight of your original intention. And if you're busy enough trying to be a business expert, you've hardly got the time to become a computer expert. Apple Macintosh is a computer system that gets straight down to business. So in no time at all, you can assess the number of alligators, analyze the market prices for skins, create a new range of handbags, shoes and wallets, print out plans for draining the swamp, and have the whole project completed in enough time to do some really long-range thinking.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of the news. We're going to keep us on track time-wise this week. You wait and see. Brings us to the part of the show that I love, the part about shopping. And first, we go shopping for me. Now, frequently, for our retro computing gift idea, when we add another item to the gift guide, which is available over at rcrpodcast.com/gift guide/gift. I don't know. Go to rcrpodcast.com and look for a link. I have frequently, when it's been my turn to choose, have chosen things that are obscure, relatively expensive, that sort of thing. But this time I'm going to pass along something that was actually suggested to me, I think by a listener of this podcast, maybe by a listener of a different podcast. On some podcast that I'm on, I mentioned how I would like to have more mugs, that my mugs are boring and I would like a collection of mugs and I should really branch out mug-wise. And somebody sent me a few mug suggestions, one of which is fantastic, and I've actually ordered one for myself, and it's this Spectrum Sinclair ZX. It's a ZX 48K look. It basically looks like a ZX keyboard wrapped around a black mug with the word Sinclair on the inside. It's only £4.99, so it's a cheap, wonderful little gift. If you're keen on retro computers or you know someone who is, this, I think, would make a lovely stocking stuffer, a lovely, you know, inexpensive gift. I'm very excited to get one of my own, so that is going to be my choice. If you know a Sinclair fan, then this is a gift for them. To continue our shopping, why don't we turn our eyes to some of the goodies available on eBay and see what we can spend maybe considerably more money on.
Before we do that, I got to say, this mug is very handsome.
Isn't it nice? I really like it.
Yeah, this is really cool.
I even like the little box that comes in. I'm quite. I haven't got mine yet, but I've ordered it, and I'm quite excited to get it.
And I think very reasonably priced. What was shipping for you? You remember? I mean, I imagine that's going to be a pretty big percentage of the item.
I ended up, from the site that I'm linking to, I ended up purchasing a bunch of things. I don't know what the shipping would have been if it was just the mug. But I remember the shipping on what I purchased was actually quite reasonable. And if you are in definitely the UK, maybe most of the EU, as long as you spend like £30, it's free shipping. I don't think worldwide, but so.
Awesome. Anyway, gorgeous choice.
I wonder.
I like it too. Yeah.
If there's a ZX81, then actually it would be the relief would be accurate because this one I think actually has
totally flush. Yes. That's very, very good. Well
right.
Spotted
okay.
You.
Yes.
Okay, so let's get shopping. Earl, take us to eBay and tell us what to buy.
I think that if you want to smell some more of that 80s smell, that you ought to get the Texas Instruments Home Computer Editor Assembler package. I'm a big fan of programming languages, programming tools, that kind of thing. I find they don't get quite as much attention as the games, and that makes sense. But among folks who really like this kind of thing, here's one for you. It's still in the shrink wrap. So,
well, mostly still in the shrink wrap.
Yes.
The 80s air has been released. It's been punctured.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Anyway, still brand new, and you could, you know, who knows? You could get this. You could use assembly language to make the next great game for the TI-99/4A, and you could make $1 million. Unless this is non-commercial only. I don't know if that's the case.
But could be.
Anyway.
Oh, I like it. This is an excellent choice. Only $30 for a buy it now.
Yes,
I like it.
Or you can even make an offer. So run, don't walk over to eBay.
$30 for this seems pretty reasonable as is, you know?
Yeah.
We might as well make an offer if they're taking it, but I think that's a good price for something like this, totally sealed. Want to get on editing them? Nice.
Yep.
Speaking of things that are sealed and releasing the 80s air, I've got a bunch of Infocom games including a few shrink wrap ones, which I'm quite excited about and want to eventually get to, and I'm quite keen. And I was doing some cleaning, and I've got one of the masks, the mask boxes. Mm-hmm. And I stepped on it.
Oh no!
that was a bit of a mistake. So whoopsie!
It died. It's flat.
So, it already had a small crack in the mask, and now the box is also not in great shape. And what's up with me having stuff? So, clearly, this is why I open them and release them, because I cannot be trusted to own nice things. I'm very disappointed. I can't believe I stepped on it. Crunch right down on the thing.
I'm sure that plastic is quite brittle by now, too.
Yep. Oh, apparently so. Yes. So eventually I'll videotape the opening of what's left of it, but quite disappointed. Not disappointing, and something that also could be opened would be my choice, and I'm going to select an Apple service part. You don't see a lot of these come up when they're still sealed. So let's say you had a Mac SE 30 and it had a logic board problem, leaking caps, something goes horrible on it. Back in the day, you could order a replacement logic board, which would be cheaper than getting a whole new computer, considering the SE 30 was $5,000 or $8,000 or something new, quite expensive. There is on eBay a still sealed Mac SE logic board as the Apple service part replacement. So it would come with no RAM, nothing that plugs into it, but it would be a brand new board. If you are the sort that has a Macintosh SE 30, and you should, because it's probably the best Mac ever, one of the problems with those is like the caps leak and, you know, the boards go bad on them. So it'd be nice to have a replacement around. I would want to get this, open it up, and recap it or make sure the battery's taken out or something so that it can be stored long term, because who knows what the shape of it's inside there, but it's probably still good and it would be exciting. So it's $200 for a starting bid, zero bids, and only 4 hours to go. So you're going to have to hope, if you're a listener, that it hasn't been, or that it's been relisted if it doesn't sell, to one of us. But that is going to be my choice, because I just liked it too much to not pick it, even though the auction will probably end before this show gets edited.
Very cool. And I recognize the box style here. It's something that I don't talk about much around my Commodore fans, but I actually was a Apple-trained Macintosh technician.
And so somebody buys this, you could put it in their SE30 for them.
I could indeed, and not even kill myself on the CRT.
Because
I know how to discharge the CRT units. Yeah, we used to have boxes and boxes of this kind of stuff in support of our Macintosh fleet.
It's a nice kind of thing. I'm hoping whoever gets this does a nice big scan of it, because it's nice to keep track of this sort of thing, like how are these labeled, just for historical purposes. And also when you open it up, what is the order of things, how are they packed, and just, you know, to keep that knowledge. Who knows what we – who. If, is this the only one of these still floating around or what have you? So it'd be nice to keep a record of how it's all packed up before it all gets opened.
And the manuals that came with being a Apple certified technician were absolutely gorgeous. The repair manuals, they're very well.
You still have them?
I don't. And I mean, actual books, later on they went to CD, of course, but at the time that they were books, they were really well done and would just lead you by the nose to whatever ails your Macintosh. So very fond memories there.
Yeah. Oh, and disappointingly, I'm scrolling down, and well, this in the text describes it as new and still sealed. It's one of those, they opened it up to show us pictures. So if you scroll down, it's all been pulled out. Oh, silly people.
More 80s atmospheres escaped.
Exactly. I want to do that. Far less appealing to me if somebody else opens the box. But yes, it's been all opened up and pulled out of the bag and photographed, so it shows you. I can see that the caps aren't leaking, the battery's not all over the place. So that's nice, but now it's really just a motherboard and a piece of foam. So okay. I'm still going to pick it, but that's disappointing.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how to identify. I was definitely going to say I would worry a lot about the caps on this, because I think, you know, like 90% of the SE30 boards have leaked. And
it's the little C ones. It's when you try to go and replace them on, like, C3, C4, it's those ones, mm-hmm. You wreck them, he says from experience.
Oh, yeah. Well, so the very last picture in this auction is a picture of one of the caps that could be at risk. And I don't know how to identify if there's a problem. It looks to me like there's a little bit of crap around the edge. But anyway, yeah.
It's not swelling or anything. So yeah. I would recap it anyway. Like, some, these boards, you have to cap them.
Yeah.
And if there's only a couple of them that are kind of hard to get to, like in, you got to just have a bit of a steady hand. It's actually relatively easy for most of them to cap these and then replace the battery. But you have to, because they fail like crazy. Like if somebody's got an SE30 and it's not, sorry, it's the caps. The caps in particular go on these SE30s, man. It is, alas, because it's still my favorite of the Macs, the old Macs anyway.
Yeah, I really like them. And yeah. I think I probably have something like 5 or 6 or something that need recapping.
Well, you should bring them to Kansas Fest next so we can have like a recapping time. Yep. We can all just do it on yours. What's the worst that can happen?
That sounds great.
Now that I've already told you I've wrecked one, let me try again. So, Michael, turning to you, what have you got that could possibly compete with a kind of shrink-wrapped TI-99 editor and the opened logic board for SE30? Well, what do you got?
I've got the original iPhone. Not an Apple iPhone, but the original iPhone by Infogear Technology Corp. So this is a desktop web appliance phone. Later on, Cisco bought Infogear, and then Apple and Cisco had to have a little discussion about the use of the word iPhone. So I'm sure that it was settled amicably, and amicably being a lawyer term for a large quantity of money. But for a somewhat less sum of money, I buy it now, $55, you too could have the latest technology from 1987, 88 on your desk.
So it should have been on the next episode. This is the 86 episode.
but it'll be sold by then.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
maybe. But I think this has been listed a couple of times, actually.
It probably has. But there's been an offer already made on it. I've contemplated it myself. So I just like the idea of having the original iPhone.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So it has a stylus, I guess it's a kind of a touchscreen. I kind of wonder if there's anything you can use this for besides just, you know, to point to when guests arrive.
No, I don't think there is much useful use for it.
Like, I wonder if it's supposed to be some sort of an internet appliance.
Yeah,
so,
I think I said 88. I meant 98. So it's not going to be in one of our shows. But
what do you know about how many shows we have coming up?
Yeah, look, I just don't think the 90s are retro enough, personally. It's interesting. I'd have it on my desk just for something different. I'm sure the phone part of it still works. Who knows about the rest? But it's very tempting. Very tempting.
Just very nice.
Something different.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the three of us have selected our three choices, and Paul can now give us his three choices.
I don't need to go through them all. Well, okay. So,
oh, Paul, yeah. You know you want to. Yeah. Tell us. Go shopping with us on eBay.
Okay, so the first and sort of more serious, most serious one that I came across was an auction for an NEC PC8201A microcomputer.
Catchy name.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about this before, but I looked at it, and what jumped out at me is that, you know, that's a Model 100. You know, the interface, it's the same as the TRS-80 Model 100. And as I looked into it a little bit, and apparently this is basically based on the same architecture, but NEC had their own branch of it, and I think I don't know how to pronounce it actually, but Kyocera, something like that, is I think the originator of this platform. And then, you know, Tandy went off one way with it, and NEC went off another way with it. But this seems like a pretty neat machine, and it didn't get much attention. The Model 100 took over. And it looks kind of interesting. There are a couple of them on eBay. This is the one that is kind of the cheapest. It's a $69.99. Buy it now, free shipping, or you can make an offer. And it's in good shape too. So I'm kind of curious about it. I don't know the degree to which one is compatible with the other, but I bet
they're
a little bit
kind of compatible. Yeah.
It's a cool looking machine, though.
Is that a technical term?
Yeah, I mean, some things are compatible, some things are
metric,
you know,
kinda
a little off. Exactly. So if you look on oldcomputers.net, you'll find four different machines of this same genre. The two you mentioned, also the Olivetti M10. And did you talk about the Keotronic K KC85, because that was another one. Mm-hmm. And if you look at them, they have very similar form factors, do very similar things. And famously, some of the last code that actually Bill Gates rolled up his sleeves and had a hand in writing. So neat little machines. I've got one of the 8201s. I really like it.
Yeah, it's cool. I've never even heard of these before. I like the little arrow collection in the top right, mm-hmm. which was sort of more like the Model 200 added arrows, not in that shape, but upright. So it had that going for it already. I like it. I like the look of these keys, and the display looks very Model 100 like. And I never even heard of this before, so very cool.
Yeah, no, I was nice pretty choice. Interested in seeing it. The I guess another sort of weird one that I came across. I don't know what to think about this, but it is a 33 RPM Bell Telephone Labs computer speech. He saw the cat, saw the cat, 1963 vinyl record. It's like a single sized, I think. And it's from 1963, and it's examples of computer speech. Basically, I don't have anything I can even play this on, but it's still, you know, it reaches back very far.
We could have a dance party at Kansas Fest and spin this sucker.
But it's pretty cool. So I'd be interested to hear it. It's nothing. It's you know, $5 buy it now, $3 shipping to me. I think it doesn't actually. Oh, it ships worldwide too. So who knows?
$11 shipping to me.
Okay.
Mm.
That's mean.
But it was kind of a weird little thing. I'd be interested to hear it, but I don't have any way to play it.
I'm a little concerned about the condition of the vinyl. Looking close up at some of these pictures, the front side looks pretty good. The flip side looks a little beaten up.
True. Well.
Cool.
Anyway.
Yeah. Neat. Fine.
But this is really awesome. I would love to have this.
What the heck? Nice. So what do you got for number three?
Okay. Number three. I'll go quickly. This one, it says Vintage Rare Original Radio Shack TRS-80 Computer Automatic Power Controller. And so what it is, I think, so I'm kind of curious to know if anyone knows anything about these, but I think it's an X10 controller probably. Well, maybe not. I don't know. It plugs into.
I think it's just a switch.
I thought it was an X10 controller, and now that I'm looking at the picture, I think if it's not controllable, then that's not very interesting.
I think it's a power bar.
Okay, I think you're right.
But no, if I'm going to have a old Tandy stuff connected to a power bar, this is the power bar I'd want. I find this a really exciting, cool thing.
It looks very cool, but the reason, actually, the discussion
it's
I would want.
Automatic.
Yeah. If you, there were a few for a few different platforms, but I know for sure for the Cocoa and there's some for the Apple and stuff. You could actually control the power outlets with your computer. You know, so there were X10 devices that are like the little Radio Shack things, and those seem like you can still use them today. You know, like I was definitely thinking about. At one point in my office, my Mac was always crashing, and you know, I had to. If I wasn't in town, I'd have to call somebody and have them, you know, hit the power button. And I was thinking, well, what I could do is I could hook up an Apple II to, you know, an Apple Cat with an X10 thing, so that I could dial in and cause it to turn my computer off and on.
Which would be super cool. Honestly, this doesn't ship to Canada. Otherwise, I would probably snake it away from you. I think this is awesome looking. For $23, I would snap this up in a heartbeat.
And if somebody
if it's just a power bar, I think it's the coolest looking power bar.
Yeah, if somebody had, imagine they've got like a Model 1 or a Model 3 or something like that, and some of the peripherals, and you get this thing, and it's like the coupe de grace, right?
Totally. I love the look of this. Love it. That's a fantastic choice. Oh, I wish this shipped to Canada. I'd be buying it now live on air. Love it. Nice. Great choice.
Great. Okay. And I'm done.
Excellent. Well, then that brings us to the end of the shopping portion, and we can then dive into the final little bits where we just do our disclosing discussions, etc., and see who's got what to add. I hear typing in the background, so probably things will appear on the notes. In anticipation of that, I guess I will therefore go first. I got two quick little links to throw out to the audience. The first is a really nice little, and by little I mean like 4-minute segment that appeared recently on NPR, which is like America's low-rent version of the CBC. It's a segment called When Women Stopped Coding. Really an interesting thing. It started with a National Science Foundation has a graph that shows the percentage of women in certain majors by field. Medical school, law school, physical sciences, and the computer sciences. Shows it starting around 1965 going up to the current date. And you see the percentages all begin low numbers, 10, 15% or so, and sort of all rise together toward the 50% mark, other than computer science. And this made the rounds, this image made the rounds on Twitter recently, where for some reason you hit 1984 and the red line for computer sciences, the percentage of women in the computer sciences, starts to go back down. The rest all goes up and the women become fewer and fewer and fewer in the computer science field. And what is up with that and what happened in 1984 to cause it? So there's a couple of segments that have been on NPR recently. I'll link to the first one. It's an interesting take, and the theory is basically the home computer, the thing that we are here on the RCR lauding and talking about as being wonderful. There is an argument being made that it was marketed, when it comes to home computers for children, very much as a boy's toy. It was a tool. When you look at the ads of kids playing with computers in the 80s, around 82, 83, 84, 85, it's almost all men. Look at all these Commodore ads. It's all boys. If there's a girl, she's in the background diving in the swimming pool, and it's all the boys around the computer. And it was marketed as, this is a thing boys do. And so by the time these people started leaving high school and going into college, the boys had hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of experience with computer science, and they just leapt ahead. And if you don't have that experience, then you go and you think, I'm in a class full of people who know what they're doing and I don't, and it becomes not a welcoming place and you're driven away. So that's one theory. So a lot of people are now looking into that and what can we do to reverse it, to become, have more parity, so the whole world doesn't seem like an episode of RCR. So really interesting segment I thought people would check out. And then another one is released recently for iOS, for people with iPhones, iPads, that sort of thing, is a piece of software called Early Computers. It's a free download with in-app purchases, but it is an 8-bit vintage text editor. So it is a text editor, but you get a keyboard and style of a particular old computer. I think 4 computers are available at the moment, so if you're interested and you want to do your text editing on your iPad, but you want it to look like something from Commodore or TRS-80, here is a free text editor for you. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. So let's see. Who else? Let's go around the table. Who else has what to say for themselves? Justify yourself, Earl Evans. Go.
I'm going to apologize to the fans in advance. I just noticed after the reinstall of my operating system that Skype did its magic of turning up my microphone volume again automatically. So I'm going to be a little overmodulated in this episode. Sorry about that if I sound a little buzzy. Aside from
apologizing to them as opposed to me who does the editing.
Yeah.
you should apologize to Earl.
I'm going to sound bad. The other thing is that I'm actually participating in a little contest to see who can write the coolest game or demo or whatever for the Micromite single board computer that I've talked about. It has a Mode 4, which is really cool graphics with sprites and sound and neat kind of stuff, and that's the heart of the contest, is write a program that can do cool stuff in BASIC on this computer. So I'm doing that, and it's a lot of fun. And that's it for me, Carrington.
Next up is Michael, who I believe just snaked something from eBay that I was intending to buy. Am I correct, Michael? Did you just buy that record?
Sniper!
I was going to get it. Oh, I'm
going to go on the record that I've got the record.
Oh, I hope you digitized it, because I too was going to say, I got to drop $5 and find out. You beat me to it. So other than that, and in addition to that, what's new with you, Michael?
Well, I've just been adding 3 more shelving units into the 8-bit bunker. So just to increase the storage downstairs. But nothing else. So it's just trying to bring more order under chaos downstairs, so I can actually move around down there, get piles of stuff off the floor.
Michael, you might have mentioned this in the past, but do you have a turntable?
Yes.
Awesome. Can it sample?
No, but the computer that it's plugged into can.
Perfect.
And we're pretty sure you do have some sort of microphone recording technology over there.
Yes, we use message sticks.
Very good.
They're a percussion instrument.
Excellent. And didgeridoos.
Yes.
It's all didgeridoos.
Digital doos.
Excellent. And Paul, what have you got to round out the show?
Well, I think not much to report, really, except that I've just been doing a lot of scanning and disk imaging and things like that. And perhaps what I should do is a kind of a resolution to say I will actually put those somewhere where people can get them once I get through them. It's that's where I've been falling down. I have a lot of scans on my computer that no one can see. So I'll just keep doing that. Playing with nicening up audio and scans and things. It's interesting stuff, but so much to do.
Well, very good, and thank you to you out there in listener land for being our listeners. We appreciate you joining us for another episode of RCR. You can find the show notes, of course, over at rcrpodcast.com, where you'll find the show notes for this show, for all our past shows. You'll find our gift guide, links to the forum where you can discuss this show and other retro computing type things. You can follow us on Twitter if you want. We are at rcrpodcast, and if you want to email us and maybe get it read on the show with the dulcet tones of Earl, you know you want that, you can send email to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a proud hat in hand member of the Throwback Network. In our show notes, Michael has just said happy 4th birthday to the RCR, so I guess happy birthday to us. Is it really our 4th birthday? That's cool. Look at us making 4 years. Nice.
Woohoo!
If you have enjoyed the 4 years of podcasting we have done, then please, maybe send us a 5-star review over in iTunes. That would be pretty swell. But consider that the tip jar, maybe. And meanwhile, thank you for listening. Hope to see you next time. And until next time,
Retro Compute.